discussions that we'll try to discuss today, maybe tomorrow as well. First of all, there is a tshuva that was brought to my attention that Rav Asher Weiss has, a brief tshuva, which is kedai to look at together. This is from his recently printed Minchas Asher. He has an essay about this in his sefer on Vayikra and Parshas Bahar, which we've mentioned already, and he cites it in this piece also, but this is a more recently published piece. It was written in Tavshin Ayin. The sefer just came out this year. But this in his Chuvas in Simen Kuf Yud Beis, so he talks about a rule that is relevant to an issue we've been talking about last week. So we pose the question, is it possible for a poel to contract himself into not being able to be chozer, which touches upon all kinds of other questions we've been considering here. Right, is this ability to be chozer, is it a special chus of the poel? Is it an isser on the poel? And is it some absolute Torah principle, or is it just a reflection of the way the Torah characterizes the poel role? So we've discussed all those possibilities, and as we've mentioned, one of the central issues that should be affected is the question of, can a poel contract himself out of it? Can he make an agreement that will stop him from being chozer? And that, on the surface, is a machlokas, the Shuvas HaRitva, that the Beis Yosef quotes, and the Shach. The Beis Yosef quotes the Ritva that says if there is a kinyan that's made that will strengthen the agreement and will prevent a chazara, will successfully prevent a chazara on behalf of the poel. And the Shach disagrees. The Shach in Shin Lamed Gimel disagrees and says, no, that's the din, that there's an objective right for the worker to be chazer, and no deal is going to undo that. Now, before you get to that machlokas, there's also a question that's really an earlier stage. Just tam, can you make a tenai? Can you make a condition that should allow one to change this rule? Normally we say, kol tenai, should be a question about that.
Mark Robertson makes the different distinction between Shemitah will cancel it, and meaning if it's like Shemitah will cancel and you're going against the Torah's law, as opposed to like saying that it won't be canceled in Shemitah. Can you say the same machlokas applies here?
Yeah, so what Eir is referring to is an interesting machlokas in the Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Makis about whether or not you have a similar situation, also Parsha related. Right? It's also a topic in Parshas Bahar, that if you have Shemitah's Ksafim in effect, which theoretically should negate a loan, you get a debt that a loaner has taken on, so can you make a deal that undoes that? And it's the same kind of question on the surface, although that's part of our issue. Is it the same kind of question? So is it that this is something as absolute, so to speak, as the cancellation of debts, or is this something a little bit more flexible? And why is it that we shouldn't want to allow someone to contract out of the cancellation of debts? You know, is it that is this not a deal between two people? Why should not any two people be able to make any kind of monetary deal they want? Is it just that if we allow that to be contracted out, everyone will have to contract out of it and the whole thing disappears? And as Aaron is pointing out, to what extent does semantics make a difference if you use different language in making a deal? To what extent is that relevant here? So that's all issues to consider. So the question, ostensibly the question that's dealt with and the question that's underneath the surface in the Ritva and the Shach is, normally we allow people to make whatever contract they want. Right? And maybe not even with the exception of Ribbis. As we discussed, when it comes to Ribbis, we know that no one has the right to contract to pay Ribbis. That's the Isser Deraisa of Ribbis. But it may still be that it's both prohibited and valid. It might be that you're not allowed to do it, but on a contractual basis, maybe it's still recognized as an actual debt. So we're not even sure whether Ribbis is really an exception to this, but for the most part, if people have a monetary agreement, so we say, kol k'nai shebemamon kayim, that if you have a deal between two people, they should be able to set whatever terms they want, and the deal should be valid. Now, there are areas where a question comes up, is that true? If they're Torah given rights, so should that make a difference? And one of the examples where it comes up in the Gemara Maseches Ksubos is, what about the chiyuvim of a husband to his wife? which are monetary and otherwise. So do you have the right to enter into a marriage where you'll say, okay, we're married, but I don't have the chiyuvim to you that the Torah obligates to me? Is that such a concept? Or do you say, no, that's not considered to be a tnai shel mamon? That's in the category of masna mashakasa b'Torah, that you are trying to condition against that which the Torah obligates, and that shouldn't be a valid tnai. So that question is ostensibly the issue here. Should you have the right to contract out of this chus to the poel, if it is a chus to the poel? But it's also a little bit separate from here, because there are some svarim that note that it's not simply a condition that's being made, but the language of the Ritva is that there is a kinyan, a special kinyan that's taking place. So some of the later svarim read the Ritva as a proof that a normal tanai would not work. That a kinyan, that puts things into a different territory, but simply to say, listen, I'll take the job, but I agree that I'm not going to quit, that's not valid. That's a meaningless tanai because that's against the Torah. But if you make a kinyan, you fundamentally change the relationship with an actual physical act that will connote a new kind of agreement, maybe that might be different. So the truth of the Shach is clearly arguing you can't even do that. But it's a question also within the Ritva. Does the Ritva say with a kinyan you can do it, but without a kinyan it doesn't work? Or maybe the Ritva says this is just a way of showing that the kinyan is a way to make the tanai work. So ostensibly, the machlokis between the Ritva and the Shach is, can you make such a tanai? But some have pointed out from the Ritva that the Ritva himself is only allowing the tanai because of the kinyan. So just that's one of the issues that we have to keep in mind when looking at this. Hi.
We say neder is gedara, right? So then with the Ritva and the Shach say that'd be problematic if you made a real neder or shvua.
The question of what does a neder mean? So first of all, when it comes to this is a Chag HaShvuah's topic, right? So there's a difference between a neder and a shvuah. But so a neder normally means that you're not going to be neder from something. You're going to stay away from a certain object. So it's questionable how it comes into play here. Sometimes you find different kinds of usages of it, but a shvuah generally is something you will do or won't do. So a shvuah generally cannot affirm or contradict the Torah. So how does that fit in here?
So it might be the Rabbanan only here.
I think the din of Kilib and Esau Avada might be only there. So probably not. I mean, the din of working more than 3 years, is what the Kesel says, might be the Rabbanan.
Okay.
But the idea that you can't be Chozer, it sounds like you can't not be Chozer, you can't preclude the ability to be Chozer. It sounds like that is the din of HaTorah, so it sounds like. So there is an interesting brief discussion here that Rav Asher Weiss has about this issue, and considering the way he looks at it is an interesting point. So he says as follows, just to take a quick look at it. So he talks about a law, I guess there was a law being passed in Israel, I don't know the background, that the law was coming to address what was going on. What was going on? That apparently there are policies that had been increasing. He mentions here, Ha'ikar Banaf Ha-High-Tech, that in the high-tech industries, apparently this was an increasing practice, that in order to hold on to their workers, they would make an agreement that the workers have to pay a huge penalty if they quit. And a penalty, which he says, "B'askumim bilti severim biachas legova scharam," sounds like it means they are unreasonable amounts in proportion to what they actually get paid. These are very disproportionate fines that they would be obligating themselves to pay if they would quit. So it sounds like there was a suggestion of a law, of a statute, to prohibit those practices. So he seems to be considering the question of whether or not the practice itself is an offense against halacha. Doesn't seem like there should be an issue with the proposed law. The proposed law, if anything, is going to come to restore the halachic requirement. But the question is, apparently the practice that the law is addressing, is that itself a violation of halacha? So perhaps the law, I don't know the history of the law other than what's suggested in the description of the Shaila here. Again, this must have been relatively recently. This tshuva is dated 3 years ago. Maybe this is an ongoing issue. But perhaps the law is suggested as an expression of what they call mishpat divri, that Justice Ilon just passed away this year, passed away a little while ago. So he was the major advocate of the philosophy of Mishpat Ivri, that whether or not the modern state of Israel will run on halachic regulations 100%, that's a different question, but that at least whatever laws that they have should be based on the values and the structures of halacha. So perhaps this law was suggested as a way of trying to restore the status quo to what the halachic attitude is. And therefore, I will read this question as being asked, that maybe the question is the status quo appropriate halachically? The fact that there was this tendency for employers to say, we're going to hold on to a huge mashkon from you guys, we're going to demand a huge penalty. If you quit, is it legitimate for the employers to do that? Now, they're doing it in advance. They're making the agreement. That's the contract. So, arguably, any worker who agrees to work for these people is agreeing to this. He understands that's a term of employment. So the question is that legitimate? Does he have the right to make such an agreement? And does the employer have the right to ask for such a agreement? Or is this a violation of the fundamental, inalienable benefit of a poel to be able to be chosen? So let's look at how he discusses the question. So he says off right at the beginning that this question that we've discussed, the major machlokas, is the poel allowed to take on a kinyan that he's not going to go, he's not going to leave? Is that valid or not? That seems to be the basis of the whole discussion. So he says the Ritva, Shuvisim Kufyud Zayin, Chidei Shad Kan Lo Amr De Poel Yochel Achzib Chatzim Ela Behisker Asma B'Psika Bilvad. That the only time we apply this rule of Pol Yochel Achzor is if they just set it as is. But if he actually makes a kinyan that he will stay, then he's obligated to stay. The Hashach, Shalom Gimel Yudal, again, this should all be familiar. Chalak Allah, the Kasa, the Kaven, the Din Torah, the Pol Yochel Achzor, Bechatzi Ayom, Mayoel HaKinyan. Since there is a din in the Torah that he can go back, so what good is this kinyan? This kinyan is against the Torah, and what effect should it have? The Hevi came with Shuvas HaRivash. He brings the Rivash as this as well. The Afshar Kasav, B'Shem Shuvas HaMabit, the Afshar Dilu HaRivash, Roas Divaher Dvayim Latal Daito. So maybe you'll say the Rivash didn't realize the Ritva said otherwise, and he would have conceded the point to the Ritva. But the Shach definitely knows about the Ritva, and Mikomakom Chalak Hashach Al Shitas HaRitva. So there's no argument that had the Shach known about the Ritva, he would have disagreed. He would have reversed his own position. The Shach openly disagrees on the Ritva. So this seems to be a machlokas, and this machlokas seems to be the question at the heart of this practice. So is this practice really consistent with this machlokas, with the Tutsdot machlokas? So he brings here a reference to his essay in the Menachas Asher and Vayikra, which we referred to already in the past. And he says he has there three different approaches how to understand what the Ritva's view is. The Ritva, that it should be possible to contract out of it, what's that based on? Now think about these approaches as you hear them in terms of what we've been positing about the nature of the poel relationship. Is it possible to change the poel relationship and its details, or is the Torah command that a poel be treated a certain way? So look especially to this first approach. This is Al-Yidei HaKinyan in Aleph. Al-Yidei HaKinyan, Asa Atzmo Kikavlon. The Kavanaso V'Kabel Al-Atzmo L'Hashlim Nesamalacha V'lo Rak L'Avod Kisher Yom. Kach Mavur V'Divrei Hashitim Mekubetzes Bav Metziah Machan Ephraim V'Divrei Hamashma De'emes L'Mahani Kinyan L'Kapeach Eschus HaPol Achzebo Atho Shittas HaRitva V'Rak Mishum Tevi Kavlon Eriyochel Achzebo. So what did you say? But apparently the nature of this kinyan is that you can change the characterization of your employment. That the kinyan is not to make you a poel who can't be chozer, but it's to make you no longer a poel. Now you are a kavlan. Now how do you understand that? I mean, it would seem to be that's only true if there is a specific task you're agreeing to finish. Don't we understand the definition of a kavlan is that you're taking on a job rather than hours? But here, you're taking on hours still. You're just saying that you'll commit to a certain amount of hours within that. So how does that become a kavlan? Seems to be a little bit of a stretch in the definition of a kavlan. that apparently the Kavlan is seeing the hours as a unit, as if it's a job, as if it's a task, and says, I agree to take on this day's work for you. And whatever the day's work, it's as if I'll do that work. It's a chiddush of an understanding. Right, but he clearly seems to be saying that fundamentally a pole can always be chozer. That if you have a by-the-hour job, you can always leave that job. But you can make yourself into a kabbalan by addressing yourself contractually to a certain period of time. I think it takes a little bit of effort to understand how that works. I don't know if anybody has any further comments on that. But it seems like what he's saying is that by making this deal, you're a kabbal on yourself that Monday's work you're going to do. Not that you're working by the hour on Monday, but that you're doing Monday's work. And therefore you have a responsibility to see it through. But it does seem a little bit of a chiddush. Second approach, says, I know the chazanish l'vavakama. Shekosiv dim yadamu shekavanas hapoel ischai v'kinyin. That if his idea was that he wants to agree that he can't be chozer, taka, that's no good. That's negated. But if he says that I will take my property and I will tie that into my showing up at work, that should be good. And just the issue is, and therefore, he thinks those two premises are basically agreed upon, that you cannot contract yourself to work without quitting, but you can contract yourself to commit your property or monetary assets as a security against your quitting. And the whole machlokus here is, what is the intent with such a kinyan? Is the intent to tie yourself into working, or to tie your assets in to cover your possible quitting? When we dvar mavur dim shibed nechasav shiv yachzav oyacham avidul lechof mimenu mahani. So it comes out that if we know that that's the nature of the deal, which is what it sounds like from these scenarios the law is addressing, is that if he makes the deal specifically about his assets rather than himself, so then that deal is valid. And then the third approach, the third approach, the simplest, is the issue that we started off at the beginning, that it sounds like the Ritva is simply saying, this is an example of kol t'nai shiva mamon, and it should work. So this gives us three fundamental different ways to look at what's going on. And just working backwards, is the issue that, yes, this is an agreement which is the default position for a poel, but it's still subject to agreement by both parties. So the parties can decide amongst themselves to switch it. That's the Ritva's view. Or should we say, no, this cannot be switched, but you can get around it by agreeing to a penalty rather than the work itself? Or that first view, that you can only get around it by fundamentally changing the characterization. A little bit similar to what Aaron was bringing up before, that maybe you're changing the language that you're using, you're making it into a kabbalah. You're essentially doing the same kind of agreement, but you're going to call them now a kabbalah instead of a poel. And how to call it a kabbalah is a little bit of a chiddush. So far, so good? Everyone here? Okay. However, on the Mashach, Naka to the Kinyan Zebalam Noah's Etzim Sosapol Achsebo, but the Shach's position is that this comes to hold back the basic right of a pole to be Chozer, and therefore it's Bato, and it's Kamas Mashkas of the Torah. And he basically holds that since this Tanai comes to Abru Mitzvah of the Torah, it's not considered a Tanai Shem Mammon, it's considered to be a condition against the Torah, and therefore it's no good. When we call Makom Benidon Didan, so it says with Asher Weiss, it seems like in this case, that everyone would agree that this commitment to the worker should work, because he never committed not to be chozer. Rather, he gave money into the hands of the employer, that if he should decide to quit, the money will remain with the employer. And now he says the key line here, Davar Zeh, Af im hu soser hu is ruach haTorah. So some of the people in this room know that Rav Asher Weiss is a big proponent of a concept of ruach haTorah, ratzon haTorah, that there are times when the Torah conveys a certain desire and a certain attitude, even if it's not spelled out as a mitzvah or an isser. So here, despite his commitment to that theme, here he says that in this case, for a person to functionally make it that he can't quit, because he's committed his assets, even though it doesn't say the words, he can't quit. He can quit and just forfeit this mashko. So it's technically okay, but it goes against the Ruach HaTorah, it goes against the intent of the Torah, so to speak. Definitely, Chazal would not approve of this, would not like this. Because the Torah says that Jews are slaves to God and not avadim le'avadim. And it's not right to hold back from a worker his ability to quit through the threat, the very scary threat of a tremendous financial loss that he can't handle. Still, despite that, we can't nonetheless say that this Ruach HaTorah issue is enough to undo and to abrogate an agreement between two people who have knowingly contracted into it. That the only way we could say that this contractual agreement is automatically nothing is if it actually went up against the din of the Torah. So if it really said that he can't be chozer, so then, okay, the shach will tell you that that's not valid. But if it doesn't say that he can't be chozer, it just puts a huge penalty if you are chozer. So then that's not a blatant contradiction to the Torah. It's kind of sneaky in terms of the Torah. It's against the Torah's ratzon, so therefore Chazal would not approve. But being against the Ruach HaTorah is not enough to make a contractual agreement ab initio worthless. Hi.
The case talks about here where it's supposedly, let's say, an exorbitant amount that they're willing to find it, but in theory it would have the same conversation if it was 10 cents, right? The point is that there's some sort of penalty they would have on their ability to be chozer.
Well, no, but then if the penalty is not scary, so then that's not going to be significant.
But the point is that they're not be able to be chozer without some sort of penalty.
No, but if the penalty doesn't stop them from doing it, his point here is that...
Oh, that it stops them.
Right, that the penalty is... He's certainly emphasizing the penalty is so scary that it's something that's going to get in their way. If it's a reasonable compensation, let's say, that you'll have something built into a contract where the assumption is that the boss is taking some kind of a loss because of this, so let him at least be compensated by the worker if it happens.
Assuming he's never up at
the... Right, so if the real loss, that may actually talk interfere with the Pole's ability to be chozer. But whatever it is, some type of a backup to the employer, that might be legitimate. But if it's davka, a number that's designed to keep him from doing this, it's a little bit evocative. It's not exactly the same, but a little bit evocative of the discussions that we find in the context of Ged Meusa. Now we know that a husband who doesn't want to divorce his wife, so we can't usually force him to do it under most circumstances. He can't be forced to divorce his wife. So then the question becomes,
so what about financial
penalties? What if we're not actually doing anything to make him do it, but that by refusing to do so, he endures financial penalties? Is that a problem? And if so, does it make a difference? What kind of penalties? If it's a penalty that he simply would not be able to deal with, so he'd for sure have to do it in order to avoid the penalty, or a penalty that he could handle, but just it means that there is some cost for him deciding not to take the step. So that's a discussion which is not exactly parallel, but certainly has echoes of this issue in the context of a get. So here too, if it's those poles first to be able to quit, so is this monetary issue get in the way? So he's assuming here that it's in between. It's against the Ruach HaTorah, it's against the attitude, but it's not an actual violation of the Torah. Excuse me. All right. So the fi kol shalosh darchei havana b'divrei haritva mahani. So therefore, he assumes that all three of the approaches within the ritva, this works. And even the shach would only argue when we're talking about the absolute zchus of the worker to quit. Shuvas chsam sofer choish mishpat kufchav beis don biisha aniya shavda kmeshareses b'beisos shel yehudi. You have this impoverished woman who works as a maid in the house of a Jew, and she left jewelry by the balabas, and she had that in the household. And one of these days, she decided to leave, and she left. So the balabas wants to know, what should he do with the jewelry that belongs to her that she left in his hands? So the Chassam Sofer said that there were people who had been motzi laz on this balabas, who had spread rumors about this employer, that when the maid wanted to leave, so he refused to give back her earrings, her jewelry, and this makes him very upset, these rumors. And the Chassam Sofer said in that context that even if that were true, even if this had really happened, he would still be zocha to these earrings, they would still be his. And that's and we assume that she probably was mochel them, that she probably essentially gave them to the boss. That was a part of her agreement, since she left the job in the middle. When she left, she presumably had intent to be mochel the jewelry that she left with her boss. So basically, it sounds like from the words of the Chassam Sofer, the emphasis that she was mochel, that it sounds like that's what did it. The fact that when she left, she knew she left these jewels there, and maybe she intentionally did that as some type of an appeasement, that's why he gets to keep it, because she was mochel. But the idea that maybe he should be entitled to it because she quit, and this was as if some kind of security to keep her from quitting, so then that's not something that necessarily emerges from the Chassam Sofer's tshuva. This is Elok Shekvodo Heir, as this is correspondent pointed out, Shafshur Shul Haisa Kavana Shalom Lassa Blabais Nizom Eilim Tafsirba, Ela Shiubiyoda Ligvos Behem Tazik Lechepsi Abayis O Tigrom Shar Nizakom Blabais. So it could be that she left those there, not really in connection at all to her possibly quitting, but in case she does some damage, if she's going to break something in the house while she's working, which we find in the Gemara, right, that comes up in some of the scenarios we've discussed, that sometimes the employer will have property of the employee as a security against damages, so that maybe that's the whole story. And it's nothing to do with any kind of protection against her quitting. So that emissly adati maramals kvoid some slaves mashminesha heskin kol shubin balabais mashrasas. He says, I don't understand where you see anywhere in the Chassam Sofer that there was any kind of deal here. The other the mashrasas if kidas tachita biabalabais kadesh is a yishmur alayhem below scaffold the oil of mashkos on the schizo. He thinks it's more logical that the woman asked the balabais to watch them. She's working for him, she doesn't have any safer place to leave her stuff. She asked him to watch her jewelry, and there's no deal whatsoever in terms of this being any kind of a collateral for anything. Is completely irrelevant that he just had her jewels because she was watching them for her. Seems like this deal is valid based on halacha. If the employer only asks that whatever he has invested in training this worker, he should get back, so then he thinks this is not at all a problem and doesn't even deviate from Ruach HaTorah. That if he invested money in training this worker, now he's not going to get any benefit because the worker quit before he could actualize the training, So then that would seem to be totally okay. So a few points. I don't know if anybody has any comments they want to make about what he said over this tshuva so far. But I think a few comments. First of all, the three mahalchim in the Ritva are very instructive just in terms of the questions we've been asking. But I think it's also interesting that, first of all, just the whole derech is that, again, he's not addressing the chok that's being suggested here. The shayla is different than the tshuva. He's addressing the status quo that the chok is there to try to address. So it sounds like he probably is pro the chok either way, because even though he's defending the status quo letter of the law, if the Jewish culture, if the Israeli government wants to make such a chok, presumably everyone should agree that it's an enhancement of society. It seems to uphold the value of the din. Whether or not it's absolutely required is a different question, but the chok would certainly seem to be compatible with the din, so it would seem to be that there really isn't much of a question here that this chok should be supported. The question just seems to be that in the absence of the chok, such a practice on behalf of the companies, and the Mela also on behalf of the workers who would agree to sign such a contract, is that legitimate? So then his basic conclusion is, it's not great, it's not Ruach HaChalim Neuchabo, but it's not against the absolute halacha, and therefore it should be legitimate. I wonder, though, also, reading between the lines, that, and I was actually discussing this with Reb Leich on the way up into the building just now, but you know, why is this something that's prevalent in high-tech companies? He mentioned specifically that it's a high-tech issue. So it seems to be, between the lines, that they are running some greater risk at having their workers quit. And it does seem to be that this is probably, possibly entering into the Chazanish territory. So we've been discussing, a little bit during Seder, that we know already from our Mishnah that if there's a loss caused to the boss, so then that interferes with the worker's right to quit. And that could even apply just to the idea of quitting itself, that the Chazon Ish's attitude against some of the other, we've shown him already the implication we find, but the Chazon Ish's psak, which the latest Svarim will talk about at some length, is that the worker can't really quit suddenly because he's going to leave the employer without any type of coverage. So he can leave if he gives warning. So we know when the Gemara uses the phrase "Pol Yochel Achzer Afilu B'Chatzi Hayom," that Chatzi Hayom is a chiddush. It's telling us something extreme, that Pol can quit even Chatzi Hayom. So what's the chiddush of Chatzi Hayom? So you can read the chiddush in two ways. You could read it as even suddenly, just gets up in the middle of the day and walks out. Or you could read it as meaning, no, it's not about the suddenness, it's just about the term. That he doesn't commit himself to any existing term, and you could assume that the minimum of a term is defined by days, the minimum of days, so the idea that even in the middle of a day he can leave is a way of saying you can't commit him to any kind of term. So what's the chiddush of Chatzi Hayom? Which one of those two? So it sounds like the Chazon Ish was saying it's the second one, but not the first. Right? The connotation that you have, the middle of the day, that the middle of the day means you don't have to give any warning, all of a sudden just get up and walk out, that's not true. Because that will leave the balabas hanging without any coverage. But if you're going to give him a warning, so then you have such a schus. So there are scenarios. His point basically is, why is that limited? Because the same way you have a limit with anything that's going to cause the boss a loss. And we saw with the sugya of Davar Avad, that it doesn't just mean money. It means also that something that you can't recover, even if it's not money. So for example, if you have a wedding or you have a funeral and you hired workers to come to play at the wedding and play at the funeral, they used to have people playing at the funeral to evoke tears. You used to have people sing at the funeral. So if the worker's not going to show up, you can't have him come back the next day. You know, the wedding and the funeral is what it is. So it's not necessarily about monetary loss. That's one case, but it's also just if the quality of what you're trying to do is irrevocably affected by the worker leaving, so then that's called davar avad. So the Chazon Ish is saying that if you're going to be left in the lurch for any amount of time that's significant, so then the worker shouldn't have such a right. So it seems to be probably with these companies they had some kind of concern like that, that workers leaving was causing them some kind of a serious issue which they had to hedge against. Otherwise, what would the motive be to create such a deal. And I was wondering also, I don't know if this is at all consistent with the norms of the industry, but maybe there is some type of technical secrets issue here. That if you have too unpredictable a turnaround and you're in a high-tech company or something like that, so then you have to worry constantly about your work product ending up in some other company's hands. Now, the response to that could be that, okay, but then you're going to say these people could never quit because that's not time-bound, that's just about access to the workers has, to the workers have to your secrets. So, probably, it's true, but you could maybe also say that there's a certain amount of reasonable turnaround that the companies factor into what they do. But if a worker could just quit at any minute, then they can't at all account for whatever kind of sudden loss they may have of their privacy, and therefore it's perhaps something that they're trying to protect against. And okay, you'll quit at the end of your contract, and we'll have to deal with that, but we need to have contracts that we can have some type of predictability when our workers may theoretically end up working for somebody else. Hi.
On a similar note, could you say like a firefighter or policeman also couldn't quit in the middle of the job?
Yeah, that's for sure. Now that's also something, and again, God willing, June, when you all be here, we'll talk about this. But the issue of workers to strike is also one of the major questions that comes out of our Karak. And of course, that's an issue where you always find a discussion that should certain workers, if you say there is a right to strike, are there certain workers, such as the type that you're mentioning, where their leaving work is so dangerous that we shouldn't allow that, and that's a major topic which we'll get to.
Why didn't the strike just, would they have the option of leaving?
Right, because it's a related issue that, you know, certain workers because of the, but here also, again, so you see within the Davar HaAvad heading, it seems to be that that's true. So I don't know, again, I don't know if anybody has any experience with any of these industries, but does that make sense at all to say that maybe there's just a technical secret issue here, that it's just too, makes the company too vulnerable to have workers be able to quit at any moment with whatever knowledge they have. And even though they can quit eventually, their contracts aren't permanent, but still, to have some kind of predictability as to when there'll be turnover, they can manage for it. But if a worker can quit at any given moment, maybe that's too much of vulnerability, and maybe that's a davar of an issue, and maybe that's why it's dafka these high-tech companies that seem to be cited here. So I think the order was Michael, Ephraim, Jonathan, is that right? Okay.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Because when I was working in Dimona this past summer,
where?
We met Dimona, Southern Israel. So the mayor of the city was telling us about how dependent the economy of the Southern Israeli society is on high-tech factories. And to not keep up with some of the other countries that produce, and they actually have bidding wars in order to get these factories from popular companies like Intel, AMD, other processor companies, etc., high-tech companies in Southern Israel. So it makes a lot of sense why they would need everybody on staff to put out everything at the best time possible.
Right, so that could be true anyway. I think that's where it goes back to the Chazanish. Right, that, you know, the Chazanish's point is that the boss can't afford to ever have understaffing. So if you're going to leave him understaffed, so then he already has the right to say he can't do that. And you have to stay, Jonathan was asking before, so what does that mean? It means, what if it takes him years to find a new worker, so then you all of a sudden have a guy who should be for years? So presumably we're talking even what's ever reasonable to replace a worker, but that you can't leave him suddenly hanging and with nobody there. So that's what I think has an issue point. What I'm wondering here is that, is there also maybe something that they're vulnerable because whatever technology that they're working on requires some type of competitive edge, and to have workers who at any minute can just leave and take it with them, that's too much volatility in order to be able to hold on to that.
Fred? I think usually people in those companies, like depending on the position, like sign a non-disclosure act.
So that would stop it from ever happening anyway. Except that, how effective?
Because otherwise they could blackmail their company and say, I'm just going to go, like Google could blackmail and say, I'm going to go to Apple and sell it.
Yeah, anytime, even if they're not, before people even start working,
for an employer, usually sign non-disclosure agreements.
But how effective is that, just in terms of these very nuanced...
Well, if you're already breaking the law, then who cares if you're...
Well, I mean, it's not so much to break the law, but it's when we have these very nuanced differences, so then, you know, it goes to also the last point that he made, that he put there. So there's also investment in training. So let's say it's reasonable for an employer to say that if I have to train the worker, then I'm doing it under the expectation that I'll get a certain amount of work out of him. And therefore, that would be even more... It doesn't address the question if that means you could stop him from quitting. It's an interesting question itself. Maybe that should be called a davar ha'avad, that if I've trained a guy, I spent whatever amount to train a worker, and then he quits after half an hour. So is that a davar ha'avad? So presumably not. It's an interesting question. Right? Presumably it's not a davar ha'avad, because the training is already spent. Now you want to get his work. But his work should be subject to the rule of poliach halachzer. But maybe from a monetary perspective, you could say that you're basically lending the education to the worker, and you're lending it to him, and you're going to forgive that loan if he ends up actually working for you. But if he doesn't, you're going to hold on to this collateral that should pay you back for the training that you did that he's now going to take somewhere else.
But training is not separate from the actual job. It's part of the job. You train, and then you just begin the job. It's not like he waited to... It's not like... Right,
so say whatever investment he put in the training, so if the company is saying, we put this investment in you and then you pulled out, we only did it audacity to get something. But he doesn't address the question here. It's interesting, should that mean that he can stop the guy from quitting? Is that a davar ha'avad or not? Maybe it's not a davar ha'avad. Maybe davar ha'avad means that I'm going to have a loss from you not working, not that I invested in you and I won't be able to realize it. It's an interesting question by itself. Jonathan?
Can you say also, I mean, I don't know what people's models are, but maybe it's possible that they say, I'm going to train 10 people and I expect two of them to sort of quit early on, and therefore that wouldn't be your responsibility to figure out if you're one of the 2 out of 10 or not.
Yeah, if that's the general assumption. But even when that's the case, you know, so you hedge for certain, it's the same way a store will account for a certain amount of losses due to theft or things like that, but it doesn't justify anybody stealing, right? The fact is still, in every case, I'm investing in you because the agreement that we had is that you will work for me after that investment. So how does that affect the ability to quit? It's an interesting question. So all he says here, Rav Asher, is that it's legitimate, that it's not against Ruach HaTorah, that he wants to hold on to a penalty. But could it actually translate into him directly contracting that he can't quit? Is that a davar ha'avad? I think that's an interesting question. It's still a little bit open here. But the fact that they may have factored into their projected profit for the year that some people will quit on them, I don't know if that's necessarily different than the calculation of how many things will get stolen. It's still wrong to steal it. Okay, so I think that was very relevant to what we've seen so far, very interesting. So we still have to, at least in summary, look at what the Yashar Yitzchak talks about. So God willing, we'll...